then they fill out a moon cushion or a sun cushion, or sometimes a sun cushion and a moon cushion. This is known as the three principal paths. Okay, so renunciation, renouncing negative states of mind, is what the lotus represents. On top of the lotus is a moon cushion representing bodhicitta, okay, which is compassion. And then sitting on top of that is a sun cushion representing wisdom. And so from the Tibetan system, they say that renunciation, compassion, and wisdom are the three principal paths that give rise to enlightenment for the Buddhist individual. So obviously, having compassion and wisdom together is very, very important. And so that's what we're going to be talking tonight about. We're going to be discussing all of us. I'm not just going to talk at you. You know the story. You've got to come up with ideas and thoughts. And firstly, we're going to talk about why those two need to go together. And I'm going to throw it open to the crew. Why do you think compassion and wisdom are friends? Why would that be so? Why would those two be important? They need each other. Nice one. Not good enough. There's a particular reason. And if you can't come up with it, we'll just sit here all night until you do. Alright, well, I will explain. Compassion is the active principle. Interestingly enough, we often think, if we're looking in terms of things of yin and yang, we often think of the moon as being the yin compared to the yang of the sun. But interestingly enough, compassion is the active principle. All right? Because compassion is an action. Wisdom is an understanding. So interestingly enough, the masculine aspect is actually compassion, and the feminine, which will come as no surprise to the women here, the feminine aspect is the wisdom. Alright? So the females hold the wisdom and the males hold the action. Alright? And it's depicted in a lot of the tantric art of Tibetan Buddhism, where there is the bell, held the bell, which represents the wisdom, and the dorji, which is the thunderbolt, which represents compassion. And in the iconography of the moon and the sun, it's the moon that is the compassion and the sun is the wisdom. And I guess also that principle too of the sun being the wisdom is that it's the sun being all encompassing in terms of its light. The only thing that obscures the sun are the clouds. So in a sense it's all encompassing, and that's actually what that wisdom principle represents. So why do they go together? Why are they so important to go together? Well, if you have, and it's very, quite simple, if you have compassion without wisdom, you have what's known as idiot compassion. And idiot compassion can be depicted as you've made a decision that you're going to be compassionate to old people. You know, you've made an absolutely conscious decision to be compassionate. And you come to a sidewalk and you see a little old lady standing on the side of the road, and you go, well, I'm compassionate, I'm going to take her across the road. Halfway across, she's hitting with your umbrella saying, I don't want to go. That's idiot compassion. It's making a decision that you are going to do something compassionately without employing wisdom to understand it. Now, there's two kinds of wisdom. There's the wisdom that sees the action, and then there's the ultimate wisdom. We'll talk about that a bit later when we talk about wisdom. But just the idea of wisdom. And I was talking to someone the other day, actually, and the difference between intelligence and wisdom, and we kind of came up with a bit of a theory. I'm going to throw it at you people and see if you agree with this. Intelligence is the ability to understand and gather facts. Right? To understand a situation or grasp it very quickly. Wisdom, in a sense, is the way that we use that intelligence. Right? you can have intelligence without wisdom. Do you all agree with that? Does that seem a reasonable way of looking at it? Again, this is just a theory that someone and I were talking about together. But if we have compassion without wisdom, we have an active principle that has no guiding parameters around it. Sure, compassion is important, but unless we have the friend of wisdom to guide it, then we have something where we are dragging a little old lady. And I told this story once many years ago, and someone said, yeah, I did that, and the lady did hit me with the umbrella. which I think was extraordinary. And I had an example once in Oxford Street in Paddington. I was walking along, this was a Saturday morning, and there was a blind girl walking along with a stick, and she was obviously blind, and she was feeling away with the stick, and she dropped a parcel, and me, being compassionate without wisdom, bent down and picked up the parcel. Now, what's wrong with that? She couldn't see me picking up the parcel. It's a natural, if you see someone drop something, you pick it up for them. I saw that she was blind. She drops the parcel, I pick it up, and I'm doing this with it. And I said, I've got it here. She said, don't ever do that to a blind person. And I went, oh, that was so dumb. I should have said, oh, touched her on the arm, said, you've dropped your parcel, can I pick it up for you? Not a perfect example of me falling into the trap of having compassion without wisdom. And all of us do that at some point. So we need to be able to temper our compassion also with the idea of how we're using it, how we work with it, with that particular person. Now, okay, so there's compassion and wisdom together. Okay, what about wisdom without compassion? It has no active principle. Therefore, from the Buddhist perspective, if we have wisdom without compassion, we're not doing anything with it. We're gaining knowledge, we're developing our knowledge, but we're being of no benefit to anybody else. And in a sense also, we're not really being of great benefit to ourselves, because we're not accumulating positive karma, we're not creating help for anybody else, and we're not using compassion whatsoever. We're just gaining knowledge and becoming extremely wise in some way. No, probably just intelligent, but not necessarily using our wisdom to be of benefit to others. So this is why they have to be together. You can't have them separated. Wisdom without compassion is a dry understanding. And it's a bit like, you know, sitting on the mountain and developing the wisdom and going, oh, look at all those poor people down there. Well, I don't care, I'm developing wisdom. <All right? laughs> Oh dear. So we need them to be both together. We need to develop this. Okay. Yep? It is wise to have compassion, that's true. Yeah, no, and that's a really good comment. But there are many people who will become Buddhist scholars who don't actually use their wisdom in a creative way that helps others. But yes, to take the true meaning of that, it would be wise to have compassion. To have compassion. But not necessarily do we do that. And this is where, you know, you could develop the most wonderful talents of debating Buddhist texts and ignore someone that needs some help. And so we need to be really able to get really clear on that. And that's why they are friends. That's why they do work together. And so in the Buddhist art of Tibet, they have the moon and the sun together. So compassion. Okay, let's have a look at that first. What is compassion? Is it looking at someone and going, ah, that poor person. Oh dear, they're suffering. Is that compassion? Well, what's that? If it's not compassion, oh, look at those poor people. Oh, they're really having a hard time.
They must be really hungry. Oh, I feel really sorry for those poor hungry people. What's that terminology? It's not compassion. What's that called? Come on, there's a word for it. Pity. You pity someone. And I can't really pity someone unless I feel a bit superior to them, can I? So, compassion is not pity. Compassion, and where we really do develop compassion, is through understanding our own suffering, our own discomfort, our own dissatisfaction, where we recognize that, like us, everyone has difficulties. Now, if we just think that we're the only ones suffering, oh, they're all okay, I have a really hard time. In a sense, we're using pity on ourselves. And it's completely useless. There is no, how can I put it, there's no benefit to suffering unless we learn that that suffering we're experiencing is experienced by all beings, unless they're enlightened or they're Arya beings. So if we walk around and feel pity for ourselves about how tough our lives are, then that becomes a self-centered experience, which not only is useless to the wider community and other people, but becomes useless to ourselves. Because the more we focus on our pitiful state, the less compassion we have for others. Oh, you're all okay, I have a really hard life. And so we have to look at that and know that compassion is not pity. Compassion in a sense is empathy with others. And this is what then truly makes us compassionate towards others. If you know someone who's gone through a similar experience, a tough experience as yourself, then you will understand what they've experienced and you will have compassion for that. It's not pity. It's almost like a sharing of that experience. And when we understand that, we can be of great use. Now, it's really interesting. I was talking to someone who had worked with a lot of people who had had a lot of grief. And I'd been through a difficult time once in my life. When I was about 30, I had a marriage breakup and I ended up staying at a Buddhist centre in Melbourne. And it was really interesting the way different people reacted to me. And I was going through a really hard time because my wife left with my kids and got involved with my best friend. So I went through a really difficult time. It was very hard. So I went and stayed with my teacher in Melbourne. And there's three or four people living at the centre. And there was one guy who just said, "Oh, I don't know what you're worried about. No, you should get over it. You should be detached. Right? Yeah, you should understand the Buddhist lesson of detachment and just forget about it." And I'm like, I didn't really want to talk to him very much. Because, yes, he was probably right. Yes, if I had great detachment, probably that was right advice. But it wasn't terribly compassionate for someone who was feeling extremely destroyed at that particular time of their life. Oh, yeah, just get on with it. And I honestly believe he was trying to do the best he could. But I also recognised that he'd never been married, he'd never had kids, and he had no understanding of the experience of separation from people that you love. He just didn't connect with it. I didn't feel bad towards him. I wasn't angry with him or anything. I just didn't want to be around him. But he kept lecturing. You know? And I'm glad you find this funny. It's a terrible time in my life. Anyway, there was one other person who was also inexperienced, and he kind of didn't say much. But he was actually easier to be around. And then there was one guy there that had been through an experience of separation from a partner. And he was great. He just let me talk. He didn't add a lot of information. He just was present with me. So if ever you get into a situation where someone's had a lot of grief, or you've been through grief yourself, you don't want someone going yabba 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 in your ear going, telling you how you should feel. Oh, you should get over this and this. You just need someone to actually be present. And this is what this other guy did. He's now a monk, actually, and he had incredible wisdom. And he wasn't a monk at the time. And he just hung out with me. Why do you want to go for a walk? Now, we didn't go for a walk and he discussed Buddhist logic on how I should deal with my emotional state of abandonment. No, he didn't do that. He just hung out. And so I understood from his action that compassion was the way that he was working with me. It was a compassionate act. I'm sure he could have found other things to do. I'm sure hang out with a miserable case that I wasn't probably the best fun. But he'd also been through suffering himself. And he actually said that to me. He said, "Oh, I know how you feel." And finally, I didn't feel isolated. I didn't feel like I was the loser and that I was going through an emotional state. And sometimes when you're with people who are practicing their particular spiritual path, when you're falling flat in your face, you kind of feel like a bit of a loser, actually. And at the age of 30, I was feeling like a bit of a loser. I'd lost my family and I was wondering what I'd done to cause that. And there was this guy saying, "Oh, you should be detached." So I thought, "Well, I'm not very detached. I'm really having a hard time here." And there was this other guy just being present. And he really helped me through a lot. And then there was my teacher, who actually had extraordinary wisdom and was working with me in very skillful ways. That was very interesting. But just being with someone who wasn't obviously my guru, who was just hanging out and being able to be present. So if you ever end up with finding someone who has gone through a hard time, don't try and tell them how they should be. Don't tell them that, "Oh, it's all impermanent anyway," because they're experiencing gross impermanence at that time and they're suffering. And also recognize something else. Whatever suffering someone is going through, they are actually going through their suffering. Like someone I heard who had lost $400 million in this last crash, and they only had $200 million left. And someone went, "Well, what's their problem?" And how about losing 3/4 of every bit of money that you have? Forget whether it's $400 million or $600 million. Say it's $6. You got your last $6 in the world, and someone takes 4 of it. Put it in perspective. Their suffering was tangible. They were quite freaked out. They obviously lived an expensive lifestyle. Their kids went to private schools. They had expensive cars. They probably had servants and groundsmen and a whole heap of things. They built up a lifestyle that was a $600 million lifestyle, and all of a sudden that just got ripped out from underneath. That's suffering. Someone breaking a nail may be suffering. And so it's not about, "Oh, well, that couldn't be suffering because they've got money left." You have to really identify that whatever a person is going through is their suffering. Due to their karmic causes and conditions, they see that as a bad time. Okay? They don't see that as, "Oh, well, I've got 200 million left." So we have to be very aware. I hope that's not a fire alarm, is it?
No.
Okay. No, stop me. So we have to recognise, really be very, very present to someone suffering and realise that whatever they're going through is their suffering. And to trivialise it could also cause them more suffering. And then to lecture them. Say, "Oh, well, you should be renounced for that. You know, that's fine. Don't worry about it. I'm renounced. You know, I'm not having a hard time over that. That again is a very cruel thing to do. So our compassion needs to be identified with the person and understand whatever they're going through is difficult for them. And then if they ask advice, maybe suggest advice. But don't ram your advice down their throat. And okay, if they're a Buddhist person, you may be able to talk to them in Buddhist terms, but not necessarily is that the case. They may not understand karma. Right? I've heard people say, in fact there was a woman I knew who was Jewish, and her daughter died of a brain tumour. And she was going, why is this happening? She was in great anguish. This is the woman I was massaging. She said, why is this happening? Well, it wasn't for me to launch into, oh, well, karma, actually. That was not the time to explain Buddhist karma to someone in great anguish. All right? Again, you have to use wisdom in that situation. Hopefully tonight what we're talking about is practical. Okay, I can talk theory, but I prefer to actually look at the practicalities of how wisdom and compassion can work together. And so, understanding this woman's anguish about the loss of her daughter was just me being there going, yeah, it's terrible. Not, oh, yeah, well, I've got an answer to that, actually. She was explaining that she had no reference point of why. She said, my daughter was such a good person. Why would she end up with a brain tumour? She's never hurt anybody. She was like 25, I think. Quite young. Why would she die? Why? Okay, from a Buddhist perspective, we recognise that karma is the cause of suffering and happiness. But again, it's not the time to be the clever Buddhist and turn around and say, oh yes, well I know why. And in the previous life she would, of course, that causes great suffering. During the tsunami a number of years ago that happened at Christmas time, there was a prominent Christian minister of this city, who shall remain nameless, who said, when they asked him about the tsunami and many people killed, he said, well, sometimes God takes retribution on the evil people. Gee, that's compassionate, isn't it? Extraordinary situation. Okay, from a Buddhist perspective, we do recognise it's karma. But you don't go and make a statement like that saying, oh, well, they were all evil and so therefore they all, thousands and thousands of people decided, you know, it was relevant that they died because of their evil way. I mean, that's just a shocker. I was appalled that someone of religion could actually be that uncompassionate. And he got into trouble with it, actually. A lot of people attacked him. And it was a really dumb statement to make, and a dumb statement to make in that thing. And it's the same with us. We may understand that someone is suffering due to karma, because of cause and effect, but it's not necessarily the time when someone's going through a great difficulty, is when you shove it up their nose and go, oh yeah, no, it's just because previous life everything was happening. So you have to be aware of those things, and this is where we develop, this is the wisdom coming in with compassion. Understanding on how would we like to be treated? If we were going through a situation like that, how would we like to be treated? Do we want someone giving us a lot of practical advice? Maybe a little bit, if it's helpful, but maybe we just want someone to understand and share those feelings with us, and allowing also the person to express themselves. So when she was telling me about this, I just allowed it to happen. I allowed her to express herself and said, yes, it's terrible, I understand. I'm sure it's terrible for you. And I even said, look, I've never been through this, but I do understand it must be very hard for you. And in that way, you can be of great help. It's not about being clever or smart in those situations. Does anyone else want to share anything that they've experienced in that way, or some situation where they have had to deal with someone who's gone through a difficult time? But you all understand what I'm getting at, don't you?
I feel with my experience, if you can say be present, then people will naturally unwind themselves.
That's right, yeah. You just have to listen, yeah. And they will find that comforting. And you often hear grief counsellors say, oh, you just give people the forum to be experience what they have to go through, to understand that they're going to go through a period of grief and allow them to be that. Interestingly enough, as much as my parents loved me, when I went through this marriage breakup and I came back from Melbourne to stay with them, my mother set about a campaign of trying to make me happy. Oh my goodness. And she's a wonderful mother and I love her, but she decided to start taking me on outings that she thought would make me happy. And I kind of needed to just sit and heal. So all of a sudden I'm going off shopping and doing these excursions. And she was constantly checking to see whether I was cheering up. And in the end, I actually had to avoid her because she was trying too hard. Now, she was trying to be compassionate, but she didn't actually know how to be compassionate. And funnily enough, she'd never had a marriage breakup because my father and mother were together. So her understanding of how to deal with this was quite... And she was very worried about me. I was going through a hard time. So she kind of did overkill. And so what I did then was I started avoiding her. I was living in the house and I go, oh, I'm going out for a walk. And one day I came home and she was sitting on the bed and she was crying. And she said, I've done everything I can and you're just rejecting me. And I went, oh no. Now I've got another problem on my hands. And so for her, it was very difficult. And I understood. And then I had to try and in a funny kind of way, it probably worked in reverse. I then started to have to be a little bit more compassionate to her, realising that there was a mother looking at a son who was in anguish and that she was doing everything she can and it wasn't working. So in a funny sort of way, in a reverse sort of way, I kind of then had to be a bit nicer to her and said, oh, look, don't worry, it's okay. Or, hello, what's going on here? But that happens too. So sometimes the people closest to you aren't necessarily the people that can work with you in the best way. And recognise that from our side, yep.
Just when you were working with your compassion for your mother, do you feel that changed you?
It helped a bit, yeah. But I was still going through a difficult time and I didn't have a big capacity for... I understood it, but I didn't have a big capacity for really helping. I think also I was a lot younger too. But, you know, when you have a marriage breakup, if anyone's ever had it, it's quite traumatic. It's one of the most traumatic things because you see your wife and or your husband and your children being taken away, and it's very, very difficult. So, you know, I wasn't in a great capacity to have a lot of compassion. However, I have to say, after that, after I got through it and healed and things worked out okay, my wife didn't come back, but we, to this day, we're very good friends. I made a real promise that I would be more compassionate to people. I kind of got it. And I said, okay, I'm going to be helpful to people after this because I understood what it was like to go through. And interestingly enough, after that, I ended up doing quite a bit of counselling. And during that counselling, I would get people coming along going, oh, it's just, you know, my boyfriend's left me. And I go, oh, okay, we can deal with this. I know what that feels like. Do you really? Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah, and I was actually, to this day, I still get people coming along saying, oh, I've had a relationship breakup. I don't know how to cope with it. And one girl I worked with for 7 months, she used to just come and sit on my couch and cry. And I'd just be present to her crying. You know, and then after she finished getting rid of the anguish, she said, oh, it's so great to just come here and unload. She was really, really upset. And in the end, she started to gradually calm down. And honestly, it wasn't that I did a lot. I just was present for her. And in the end, she kept sending me these people who were going through the So business was quite good in the misery state. But it really was. It wasn't a complicated thing that I had to do. It wasn't, and she wasn't a Buddhist, so I wasn't sitting down talking about karma and stuff. I was just allowing her to be, well, just being available for her to have someone to talk to. So that's compassion. That's the active principle. All right? Yep.
When you say being available, being there for the person, right? To some point, we need wisdom as well. Like
we what?
With wisdom as well.
Yes.
I think so. What's the best way? Like how to be available?
How to be available?
Yes. So is it just right there?
I think what she meant
hard to be available with is the, so instead of just being compassionate to the person that's talking to you, but at the same time you also employ wisdom into the conversation,
yeah,
into the, like, how to reply to the other.
That really, okay, wisdom in this sense, and I'm not talking about ultimate wisdom or ultimate compassion, because I'm going to talk Buddhist after that, but I'm just talking on a practical level. Wisdom only comes from experience. Okay? So, all you can do is the best you can at that stage. Alright? You can't grab wisdom and go, okay, now I'll have some wisdom. It only comes from experience. Alright? And wisdom is the result of good judgment. Okay? And good judgment comes out of experience, and experience comes out of bad judgment. Alright? So it's doing the best you can with what you've got at the time. And the other part of it, and this is part of the wisdom, is being patient. Not trying to find a solution in your head that you can shove onto someone so they stop feeling bad about themselves. Alright? But you can only do the best with what you have at the time. So my level of counselling now with people, hopefully, will improve over time. That's all. I'm hopefully in 10 or 15 years, I'm doing a better job than I'm doing now. But at the moment, all I have is what I've got to work with at this time. So that's your wisdom. What you have at the moment and what you bring to the table with that person is your wisdom. You can't acquire it any other way. Sure, you can understand principles and things, but ultimately it's only what you have at the time. And so that's the best you can do. And if you're the person at the coalface, then you're the best person to be there. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So you have to be, in a sense, compassionate to yourself. If you sit around going, oh, I'm not qualified to help this person, so therefore I'll walk away. And I'm talking about a friend who's going through a difficult time or a relative. Oh, I don't really have much wisdom or compassion, I'll leave. No, you're there. But being patient with them is probably one of the most traits. Would you agree with that, with, you know, anyone that's been through this? Being patient with them. Yeah?
Just wondering, you have a lot of people coming to unload their problems to you. So people come in and they just cry. How do you feel? I mean, when you're inside the room when someone's crying, how do you...
I give them a lot of tissues for a start.
But one thing is, when someone's crying, you don't feel too good, do you? And you have to deal with many people crying.
Yeah.
How do you cope with that?
No, well, okay, you're asking a personal question. How do I cope with that? I recognise that they're there for help. I recognise that I have to do the best that I can do. And when they walk out of the door, I don't hold on to it. I really not hold on to it. Okay? And I think the difference between that is that the people that are coming to me are not my mother or my brother, or do you see what I mean? They're people that are often strangers. So in a sense, I'm not going through their experience. You know, I can empathise with it. I might have had a similar experience, but I'm not going through what they're going through. And I have to. It's like you sit with them, but you also have to have a part of yourself that is watching for an opportunity to maybe say the right thing or not say the right thing. So you have to develop, it's like the watcher in meditation looking for agitation and dullness. You have to have a certain quality of also sitting back with it. So you can't get immersed in them and, you know, so obviously sometimes the tears are trickling down my face too because there's some extraordinary stories. But even while you're doing that, even while you're empathising quite deeply with that, you also have to have a part of yourself that sits back and actually watches and say, okay, I've also got to be useful here. I've got to do the best I can with this, so I've got to hold back a little bit in terms of becoming enmeshed in their problem. So, is that answer the question? Yeah. So, you have to do that. Now, that's on a practical level of working with compassion. From a Buddhist perspective, in the Tibetan system, they call it bodhicitta. And that's the ultimate compassion. And the ultimate compassion is becoming the best possible vehicle for using compassion that is possible. So from a Buddhist perspective, that's becoming a Buddha. So the moon cushion sitting under the Buddha is also what's known as ultimate compassion or bodhicitta, or bodhi means mind, heart. Bodhicitta means the absolute decision to become a Buddha, to remove the suffering of all beings, because it's only the Buddha's wisdom that can be absolutely perfect in terms of the right interface that each individual needs. Because a Buddha's mind is omniscient and knows every past, present and future karma that you have created and will create, then their ability to help you is infinite as their consciousness. So the moon cushion not only represents everyday compassion on a practical level, but it also represents the ultimate compassion, which is to help all beings out of suffering without discrimination, without the idea of, well, I'll give you a hand but I'm not so fond of you. Buddhists don't do that, thankfully. They don't have a desire to help those that they care about and not help those they don't care about. They help without exception. So the moon cushion also represents the complete compassion, the most altruistic view that you can have, which is to become enlightened for the sake of all beings. That's the bodhisattva principle. That's, in a sense, the Buddha in training. So that's the ultimate compassion, actually. And that's represented by the moon cushion. And there's two kinds of bodhicitta. There's wishing and venturing bodhicitta. Wishing bodhicitta is having the aspiration to become a Buddha for the sake of all beings. And venturing bodhicitta is actually doing it. Actually doing the practice. So in a sense, there's no point just going, yeah, I really do want to become a Buddha. A bodhisattva goes about actually becoming a Buddha. Watches their mind, watches their ethics, watches their wisdom, all those different things. So then you have the six functions of a bodhisattva. Which are, what is that noise? That's the weirdest rock band I've ever heard. I hope you edit this. So the transcendental actions of a bodhisattva, what are they? Speak up. Yes, generosity. What? Patience. Yes. Generosity. Well, it goes generosity, ethics. Right? Yep. So, okay, well, let's look at generosity. Generosity is actually giving. Ultimately, a bodhisattva can even give their body. You remember the story of the Buddha with the lion? Do you remember that story? No, you don't know? Okay, someone speak up. What happened with the Buddha before he was a Buddha and there was a lioness who couldn't feed her cubs? Come on.
I think I heard the big story on
the
like a tiger or something.
Oh, a tiger, a lion, doesn't matter. Actually, it probably was.
He hit the person. Yeah. Then he saw a tiger or something like that. He was trying to feed the cub, but couldn't.
That's right.
So he actually offered himself.
That's right. And do you know what he said?
Yeah.
He said, I'm going to offer my body for this cat-like creature. Lion, half lion, half tiger, whatever it was. I'm going to offer my body to this lion so she can eat, so she can feed her cubs. However, when I become enlightened, these are to be my first disciples. And, interestingly enough, when he first left the palace and he met the wandering Hindu ascetics, remember that? They happened to be the cubs and the lion, and so he stayed with them for 6 years, and then eventually, when he became enlightened, they became his first disciples. So he got his wish. He said, if I sacrifice my body for this lion, then they are going to be my first first pupils that went on to come in long for life. So that's the ultimate compassion. He gave his body to the lion. But we also have to have wisdom there. Unless we have the capacity, don't start chopping your arms off and chucking them to the lions, because it may end your life and it may reduce your ability to become enlightened. So again, you have to have some wisdom. Alright? Don't start sacrificing yourself until you know you can definitely sacrifice yourself. Alright? But, and that is important, we have to be compassionate within our own limits. There's no point running around and all of a sudden having this burst of altruistic compassion and going, I'm going to give all my money away. And then 2 weeks later going, damn, I'm really disappointed about that. I'm really grumpy. I shouldn't have done that. No, give within your capacity. It's very important to do that. If you give and then regret, then you actually get negative karma from it. It's a hindrance. So know your capacity. Alright? Know your capacity. And if you know your capacity, then you can give very freely, and as it increases, you can give more. So generosity is the first action. Compassion. And then it's ethics. Alright? Morality. Now, we can look at all the codes of different morality, the different religions and within Buddhism. But true ethics is not harming another person in action or deed. That's true ethics. And that's compassion. So you don't steal and you don't lie and you don't cause difficulties for others through your... And we can see it in when any person of religion, when their ethics fail, what destruction that causes. In America, there are complete dioceses of the Catholic Church that are completely bankrupt because of the action of some corrupt priests in payouts for their bad actions. Complete communities of Catholic people have to leave that church because it's been bankrupt because of the immoral acts of those particular priests. And it's happened right across the board of the Catholic Church. So, even if you have eloquent words, and you even appear to be compassionate, if your morality isn't there, if your ethics isn't pure, then your whole faith crumbles. True spirituality is based on good action. You can't have bad action and expect just because you have eloquent words or even you're generous, does not work. Remember what I said about the generosity and anger earlier? I was just saying earlier that I'm trying to remember the words now. You probably remember them better than me. Even a boss who is generous, a boss who has generosity but anger will still not be trusted. So, say you're a boss of a group of people and you're very generous but constantly abuse them, your generosity will not be accepted. You could give them a lot of money and still be cruel to them, and they will only remember the cruelty. And that's the loss of ethics, in a sense. Being angry with someone and harming them, even if you're generous, doesn't work. So that's the second thing, ethics, good morality. How do we treat people? How do we not harm them? And then patience. Being patient, because patience is the antidote to anger. And that's the other action of a bodhisattva. Being patient, being willing to undergo suffering for the sake of others. That's a difficult one. That's really hard. I was being patient, but it took too long. So we need to develop patience in the actions with all. And so when we were about to, I saw it today, I was driving along and a guy in a big four-wheel drive pushed in behind me and another car beeped him. And an unusual gesture went out the window. Well, the guy behind him was probably just warning him that he actually got a bit close and he was really pushing in. But this guy was like, nah. And there was an unusual hand gesture that went out the window, and I thought, you've just created a situation of negativity. Okay, you pushed in, someone beeps you, leave it at that, you did the wrong thing. Cop it, sweet, you were naughty. But don't turn around and be aggressive, because you've just created yourself an enemy in a future time. Because karma expands, that negative gesture of anger has just created another negative karma that you're going to have to deal with. So, and driving on Sydney roads is about the best place you'll ever learn to develop patience. Because people are so aggressive, and the more uptight they get, the more stressed they get, the more aggressive they get. Yeah, that's really good. Thanks, Paul. Yeah. So, if you do start to get angry, observe the anger. Don't add coal in the fire. I'm angry because. If you put the because in there, you could get angry at a lot of things. But just see that negative emotion come up. Knowing that anger is a negative emotion, not, oh, I'll just be angry for 10 minutes because that feels good. No. Can't I just be angry a little longer? I've actually had someone say that to me. They were really angry at that person. I said, just drop it. Well, can't I just have another 5 minutes of it? What, you want to indulge in anger? Yeah. I feel like I'm justified. Justifiable, ain't it? Yeah, great. So, recognise that anger is a negative emotion and have patience with it. Be patient. If we constantly get frustrated and angry all the time about everything that comes up, we're ruining our health, we're ruining our relationships with other people, and we don't have a good time. As I said before, the destination sucks. It's called death. So you better enjoy the journey. Alright? Because if you're not enjoying the journey, you need to know how to. Buddhism's not a practice of misery. Although we talk about the Four Noble Truths of suffering and recognising the pervasion of that, we still actually have to spread happiness about it. You know, there's no point walking around going, yes, I'm really religious, and being really negative. It doesn't work. We actually have to develop a quality. That doesn't mean that we can't be serious and focused when we need to be. It's not about being flippant all the time. But knowing that really, we have to learn how to enjoy this journey. You know, I don't think Bodhisattva's going, oh, gee whiz, I'm getting enlightened soon. I don't think that's their attitude.
I mean, that's been the one thing I noticed when I saw the Dalai Lama. People ask him really complex questions and sit there and go, ooh. And he sort of giggles and laughs.
He enjoys himself immensely. Yeah. I've got a picture of him in the Kala Chakra, right, which he did in 1996 in Sydney. And they did a whole book. And he was at, it's a fascinating picture. They took him to the art gallery, I think, and there were some Aboriginals doing traditional Aboriginal dance. And everyone's sitting, you see this picture, and everyone's sitting there like this. You know, they've got the, and he's like, he's absolutely enthralled. He's totally present with what's going on. This is how we become engaged. It's not like, oh, right. Aboriginal dancing again. He was right there. And when he talks to people, it's the scariest thing. I have had the pleasure of meeting the Dalai Lama, and I'll say scary on one level. His in concentration when you talk to him is just, it's like a tidal wave. He talks to you. He's right there. And all of a sudden you feel at one moment you feel unbelievably exposed and totally accepted. And it's the weirdest experience when someone does that to you. It's like, oh my goodness, he's looking straight through me and he's actually accepting me. So there's this kind of shaky ground, but it's amazing. He has this ability. And I saw, has anyone seen on television Kerry O'Brien? You know, the reporter? Hard political reporter, tough man, handles all politicians with consummate ease. It was in the... with contempt, yeah, consummate contempt. And he was in... there was a conference in the bottom of the entertainment centre during one of the Dalai Lama's tours, and it was some business heads, all the top business people, and Kerry O'Brien sitting there, and I was doing security, so I thought, oh, I really want to see what's going on here, so I kind of, oh, you can be relieved, I'll do the security gig. Anyway, so I was standing there, and the Dalai Lama's cracking jokes about, oh, so now I'm a consultant, he said, I'll be charging you all, and he was just cracking jokes, and he was laughing away. And Kerry O'Brien goes, oh, Your Holiness, can I ask you a question? And the Dalai Lama goes, what? And poor Kerry O'Brien, he went, he's red-headed anyway, but he went bright red, and he went, he completely lost it. And I thought, oh my goodness, he's just being laser-beamed by the Dalai Lama. And he finally got his question out, but it was like, he just went to pieces, and I thought, you know, there's this quality of being totally present. And the Dalai Lama wasn't doing it to freak him out. He's, that's just the quality of his mind. The power of his mind is completely present. And so being present, and this goes back to the idea of helping with compassion, being totally present with what is going on to the best of our ability allows us to develop that wisdom. You know? Instead of, oh yeah, tell me a story about compassion. Yeah, yeah, I wonder what I'm going to have for lunch. You know, that's not being present, and that's not being compassionate. Or, oh yeah, but did I tell you the time that I really had a sore foot, you know? Again, we're not being present. So it's developing that quality of patience. Patience and presence. Okay? So we've gone through ethics. No, sorry, generosity, ethics, patience. Come on, what's the next one? Speak up.
Effort.
What?
Diligence.
Spell it.
Diligence.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm sorry, I got you. That's an interesting word. I haven't heard it expressed that way. It's joyous effort. Joyous effort. This is part of the, this is the journey, you see. Joyous effort. Absolutely enjoying what you're doing. So, in a sense, diligence is the word, but it's more than diligence, it's actually joyous effort. And enjoying the process of living this life. And the only way we can do that is becoming extremely present. Do you have a question?
No?
Oh, you want... yeah, okay. So, well, I'll do it again. From the top. Generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort. Okay, so joyous effort is being again present with the activity. So it's like, okay, I'll give you an idea. Does anyone enjoy washing up? You enjoy washing up. Hey, that's one. Why?
I don't know, it feels good.
You like it? Okay.
I feel like I'm doing something useful.
Very good. Okay, good. Okay, so that's one. Is there anyone here that doesn't enjoy washing up? Come on. I want a bit of honesty here. Oh, what? So you all enjoy it? Washing the dishes? I suppose you've all got dishwashers on you.
No, I don't dislike.
It's just... it's,
yeah.
But it's a bit average, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right? Okay. Go on. It's a great practice. Okay. You can be present, and the other thing that you can do, you can even do an extraordinary practice with washing the dishes. I am cleaning the suffering from all sentient beings. I am removing the negativity of all sentient beings by my action of washing this plate, I'm removing the suffering from all sentient beings. And all of a sudden, it's surprising how clean we want to get the plate,
actually.
Yeah.
But isn't it good that after you eat a whole lot of pork and beef and chicken with a plate, then you still like, if we can still say that we are enjoying the, like, cleaning the disease, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, yeah, whatever's on there, we're just cleaning it up. We're getting rid of any bits of scraps that are on there to absolutely, so we can see it as purifying our own mind or purifying the minds of all sentient beings. So we can turn a mundane action into an action of the bodhisattva. And this is how we work with our mind. It's not just, oh, well, I'm going to be a Buddhist while I sit down and meditate and then I'll forget about it. It's about taking any small action and turning it into a transcendental action of that activity in the bodhisattva. So that's joyous effort. Right? It's not just about your own practice, it's about, well, in a sense, our practice is us. We're doing the practice now. Not just when we walk into a temple or when we walk into, you know, somewhere to sit and meditate. We're doing the practice now. What we're doing right now is our Buddhist practice. So it's about being present to that function at the best that we can at any one particular time. And that is the level of wisdom, understanding what we're doing. And that's how we learn. And recognizing when we've been unskillful, not to go there again. Not to give ourselves a hard time particularly. It's not about feeling guilt, it's about intelligent regret. Knowing when we've done something that I could have done better there, and going, okay, well, I could have done better. I'll now do better next time that comes along. Or say you've gossiped to someone and you thought, oh, that was really bad form, I've really said the wrong thing about them. Then going, okay, I'm going to try hard not to do that again. That's how we develop the wisdom. Okay, so make a mistake, learn from it, move on. Don't wallow in it and go, oh, I'm a terrible person, or, oh, I really should have paid that person back that money, oh, I feel terrible. Oh, I really should have paid that person back that money, oh, I feel terrible. And you go there and do that for years on end, instead of going and paying back the money. Or saying to the person, I'm really sorry, I can't pay you back, I apologise, and is there anything else I can do? Just working with it, instead of just feeling terrible about something. As one Tibetan monk said to me, he said, guilt is like getting into the car and not starting the engine, just sitting there. Intelligent regret is getting in there and going somewhere with it, recognising what you can do, how to fix it, doing the best you can to fix it. And some things we can't fix, but at least we don't have to repeat them. That's important. Okay, so then we've gone from there, from joyous effort or joyous diligence, to, what's the next one?
Concentration.
Yeah, concentration. Because that's the thing that sharpens our mind. That's the thing that really gets our mind working the way we want it to. And again, that's an action. So here we have this extraordinary view of becoming a Buddha, and here are the six actions, or five so far, that actually take you there. Develop these and we're on our way to becoming a Buddha. And if we know a lot of people that have suffered, this is the best possible way of helping them. All of you at some stage has had someone that you care about that has passed on. Maybe it's a grandmother or a grandfather, or it might be someone closer. And we go, oh, there's nothing we can do, they're dead. But if we became a Buddha, we could help them in future lives. We could really absolutely help them from beginningless lives that they're going to continue having, and actually help them out of samsara. That's a goal that we can have if we've lost a relative or someone that we care about. That in a future time we'll be a Buddha and we can see how we can help that person, and the fact that we've even had a connection with them will make it easier for us to help them once we're a Buddha. And ultimately all sentient beings. So there we have the practice of concentration, developing our strength of our mind, developing our analytical meditation, being able to concentrate on things and develop our minds so that we can be of great benefit. Again, this will help with our wisdom in helping people. If our concentration's good, when we listen to someone, we'll actually hear them. What are the six actions, five actions so far? You can have some coaching. What's the first one? Yes. Yep, good. You're on your way. Hey, you got three? Yep. Come on. What's the last one? Oh, funny you got that. You get a gold star. Okay? You've done very well. Okay, and then the last one is wisdom. So here you have, it's really interesting, isn't it? Here you have the practice of compassion. To be bodhisattva, the ultimate compassion that one spends their whole life becoming a Buddha for the sentient beings, and not only lifetimes. And the final one is wisdom. So there you have the action of a bodhisattva, the action of ultimate compassion, and there in the sixth one is wisdom. And that's the wisdom that, and we talk, and again, there's kind of relative wisdom and ultimate wisdom, as there is relative compassion and ultimate compassion. Relative compassion is helping anything, anyone, any person that comes along. Being available to be compassionate in the best possible way that we can. Ultimate compassion is becoming a Buddha. And so then we also have relative wisdom, having our heads screwed on and knowing that we're not going to drag that poor old lady across the road because she may not want to go, and we may actually ask her first, would you like to go across the road? So using that level of wisdom, so that's relative wisdom in a sense. And then we have ultimate wisdom, which is the view of reality. It's the way all things function. It's the way actual things exist. It's the way phenomena exist. That's the ultimate level of wisdom. Because once we know how all things exist in their true way, then we have a way of cutting through our delusions, extinguishing our karma. And from the Tibetan Buddhist point of view, it's the knowledge of the emptiness of self and the emptiness of phenomena. Knowing that all things are a composite of elements, and that there is no true essence to any of those things, and that everything is a dependent arising. Empty of inherent existence and a dependent arising. This is a really complex subject. In fact, I was teaching it last night at the Tibetan Buddhist Society, and I was sitting there and my eyes... It's very difficult to understand, but in a very simple way, I'll just use this example of this cup. We look at that, it is a cup, we call it a cup, we use it as a cup, but there is not one atom in there that is the cup. Okay, stick up your hand to agree with that. Be careful, I might ask you why. Yeah, you agree with that?
Well, it's only from my experience that I've been told to see the
cup. That's right. We impute cupness on it. And the cupness that we impute on it almost seems like it's independent of the cup. It's not. It functions as a cup. We use it as a cup. Conventionally, we use it as a cup. Ultimately, wherever we go, it's not the cup. If we look at the handle, that's not the cup. That's the handle. If we try to find the handleness in the handle, we can't find that either. So the more we look, the more we find that this is empty of an inherent existence. If it wasn't empty of an inherent existence, it's always been a cup, it always has been a cup, it could not be created and it could not be destroyed, which is ridiculous. That was once a lump of clay. Well, why don't I call, I'm going to have my tea in a lump of clay. People would think I'm ridiculous. But it's as much a lump of clay as it is a cup. But if we look at the clay, we can't even find one atom in the clay that's the clay. Do you see where I'm going with this? Now, this view of reality, and I'll tell you why we're looking at it this way, it's not just an if. Someone said to me, so what? Yeah, okay, big deal. There's no cup there. Yes, there is. I'm drinking out of it. So we have a conventional cup, and then we have the ultimate cup. The ultimate cup is unfindable. There ain't no cup there in any of its atoms. But it functions. It's labelled as a cup. It functions as a cup. Conventionally, it's a cup. Ultimately, it's not a cup. Ultimately, that's not a lid. Ultimately, that's not a desk. It may stop one day. I think we've discovered perpetual motion. Ultimately, nothing is findable. Alright? Nothing is findable. And the same goes for us. We impute this sense of I on the constituents that we look at coming together. But there is no ultimate personality-based Rod Lee. That is unfindable. Yes, Paul? Nothing what? Oh, things are happening. Function, movement, everything. But they're not inherent, no, the word, to say nothing is happening, in one sense, you have to be careful here, semantics is difficult, but if you say nothing is happening, you can move into what they call nihilism, which says nothing exists. Okay? So be careful of the words. We just have to say nothing is inherently happening. You have to say that, you have to use that qualifier, because if you say, oh well, that cup doesn't exist, well, what am I drinking out of? It doesn't exist substantially, independently as a cup, but it exists as a functional thing. So when you can say nothing is happening, nothing is inherently happening, but things happen. I can pick, that's a happening, picking up a cup is not. So why is this important? Why is this view of wisdom, this ultimate view of wisdom, important? Because if that has no inherent cupness about it, it also doesn't have, ultimately, my cup. You get what I mean? I can't be attached to something that is empty of inherent existence, if I truly understood it. I'm not talking about an intellectual understanding. There's a level where, in the Tibetan system, you enter the first bhumi, where you see emptiness directly. It's the level of an arhat, where you see emptiness directly. Then there is no attachment towards anything, because empty, everything is empty. It's empty of your attachment as well. So ultimately, the reason for this line of reasoning is that if everything is empty of inherent existence, everything's the same. Everything is the same. There was a great story funny story actually. It was written in a book called Blazing Splendor, and there was this hermit who lived in a tree outside a monastery, and he just hung in this tree. This is where he lived. And they said, well, you know, oh, he said, no, some people like living in the monastery in a house. No, I just like living in this tree. And in the tree, he had this big box. And in the box was gold and silver and rotten food. And people would give him things, and he'd just go. There was no difference between an apple or a piece of gold for this yogi. And he said, oh, you know, people give me things, he chucked it in the box. He had no attachment whatsoever. Anyway, this guy would come, a group of people came and said, they realised he was quite realised, and they asked him for teachings, and he said, oh, yeah, maybe come tomorrow. And gradually, everyone disappeared except this one guy. And the one guy came out and kept pestering. He said, oh, all right, I'll give you teachings, but you have to stay for 6 months. So he got what he wished for. And he gave this profound teaching for 6 months to this one guy that had hung in there for 6 months. All the rest of the time, he's never going to teach, and they left. But he was completely unattached to anything. Living in a tree with a box full of all these jewels, and people would give him offerings, and he's just gone in the box. He was completely okay with everything. So once we see that everything is empty, we then can lose the attachment and the aggression of trying to hold on to it, and the fear of losing it, and ultimately within ourselves. And it's when the mind finally transcends that grasping that one becomes free, because that's actually what we want. We want to be free of the sufferings of samsara. So we have to develop this level of wisdom. So firstly, the way we develop it, I like being practical, is to get an intellectual understanding of it. And then we meditate on that intellectual understanding until it flowers into true reality, into true understanding and wisdom. So, there we have. We have ultimate compassion, becoming a Buddha. We have ultimate wisdom, understanding how everything functions. The ultimate reality that everything is empty of inherent existence and a dependent arising. And we have those two together in the moon cushion and the sun cushion, and then we have the complete understanding of how those two are friends. And then we have the relative level of compassion, being totally aware of when someone needs help. And the ultimate level, the relative level of wisdom, knowing how to be helpful when that help is necessary. So it's in a sense, I haven't put it together in this way before, actually. I hadn't sort of seen it in this way. You've actually helped me put it in those terms. Someone asked me what I was going to talk about tonight, and I said, I'll find out when I get there. I had some idea, but it's actually understanding those things that help us work with daily life and our ultimate goal of becoming, hopefully, an enlightened being. Now, questions? You've got one. I knew you would. Come on. But you have to speak up.
Exhausting all my question quotas.
Okay.
But just one more.
Yeah, yeah, good.
This is with regards to the tree yogi. When he makes people wait like that, I couldn't see the compassion inside. So
it's quite common for great teachers to not throw, how can I put this? It's quite common for great teachers to extract a level of commitment before they give great wisdom. It's almost like you kind of have to pay your dues. It's like learning a violin, you know? Here's a violin, now go and play in the orchestra. You actually have to do the patience thing. And if that yogi, and I wasn't there, but if that yogi just went, oh yeah, I'm going to just teach everyone that comes along, then maybe the people that were going to really use that information wouldn't value it. I'm not sure really, but great teachers often extract a degree of patience, you know? And also one has to request, you know? Otherwise, and this is really in Buddhism, if you walk around and say, oh, listen, you know, if I walked out in the street and say, oh, listen, I'm going to talk to you about emptiness, that's an extremely bad thing to do. You have to be invited to teach. And you have to be requested to teach. Otherwise, you become a proselytizer. It's a good word, isn't it? You go and hassle people. Nah, come on, become a Buddhist. It'll be good for you. Oh! You know? Thankfully, this is one of the reasons I was attracted to Buddhism, that we don't do that. Because it's kind of like an act of violence. Hassling people to become Buddhist. Terrible. And unfortunately, there are some people that do that, but I'll also say to you, the people that knock on your door that are selling Jesus, be compassionate to them too. Alright? They're doing the best they can with what they've got, and they are actually sacrificing their lives because of their commitment. And unfortunately though, I'm always compassionate to the Jehovah's Witnesses, but they keep coming back. Every time you're nice to them, and it happened actually well before I was a Buddhist, because I was always interested in all different religions. I did a study of just about all of them that I could when I was young. And one Saturday morning, some Jehovah's Witnesses came to my door, and I was about 12 or 13, so I started asking them questions. And, you know, they gave me the watchtower, and I chatted to them, and then the next Saturday morning, they came, well, you know, fertile ground, young 12, 13-year-old, interested, so they came again and chatted to them more, because I really wanted to find out. I didn't have any desire to become a Jehovah's Witness at that stage, but I really wanted to find out what they were about, and this happened for three Saturday mornings, and then the fourth Saturday morning, I was out, but my parents were home. And my mother was a Presbyterian Christian, not terribly devout, but had sort of grown up that way, and so they knocked at the door, and the Jehovah's Witnesses come there, and they go, "Where's Rod?" "Well, what do you mean, where's Rod?" "Oh, we've been coming every Saturday morning chatting to him." And when I got home, my mother said, "What religion are you taking up?" So I freaked her out a bit, but it is important to be compassionate with all beings. Alright? Even the ones that have to be. It's very important to be compassionate and patient with them. Yep? Ethics, yeah. Question about ethics, yep.
Thinking of like, it's very different depending on what group you are being on. For example, like, and it also depends on what period of time you're living on.
Yes.
For example, if, say, Holy War was considered being ethical when you are on.
Ah, good. Okay, so I know where you're going. Yeah. This is a good question, actually. Yeah, thank you. Go on.
I know that if in the point of view of the church, if you disagree with a dogma or creed or of the Bible,
you're unethical.
And you're unethical.
Yeah, good.
And the thing is, people sometimes claim that in the name of God, like
that's right.
That's my glory and they glory.
Yeah, sure.
And even those who claim that those who are worshipping other gods, they're considered
unethical. Yeah,
because
good.
You're
okay.
Considered being worshipping demons.
Yeah, okay. Good, okay.
And so, if what is the, because I've given from
Yeah, sure. So did I.
And the thing is, so for example, like, corruption, you probably familiar with the tithing system,
I think. Giving 10% of your income to the church, yep.
Yeah. And before, like, when, perhaps on the 16th century, this tithing was very popular, and even Martin Luther King doesn't really care about like
tithing. Okay.
And it's becoming more and more popular in the 20th century.
That's right.
And
not tithing would be unethical. Okay, I'm going to stop you there because I think we need to just thank you for that. That's really good. Okay, so here's the question: at various times in history, certain things were considered ethical. Certain things were considered unethical, particularly within the Christian church. So, during the Crusades, it was considered ethical to attack the Muslims and gain the holy city of Jerusalem. And one of the interesting things, there was a monk called Mad Michael, they called him. And so he wasn't too smart, but anyway, Mad Michael went to England particularly. And he had an edict from the Pope at the time, we're talking about the 13th century, 12 something or other, And the Pope had said, if you take back the Holy Land for me, if you die on the way, you'll go to heaven. If you don't die on the way, you'll still go to heaven. And anything that you steal, you can keep. Well, there's this old farmer. He's munching on his raw turnip, going, well, I'm not having such a good time eating this raw turnip and wearing these rags. If I march across Europe with this mad Michael, the monk, and I kill and whatever, I'm going to go to heaven. I'm going to get rich. And if I die of old age and don't get killed in the battle, I'm going to go to heaven. What's there to lose? So huge groups of Germans, French and English marched on the Holy Land and killed so many different people. What they didn't realise is that not all Christians spoke English, French or German. So they ended up killing a whole bunch of Christians as well, and looting and doing terrible things. That was considered at the time ethical behaviour. Alright? So, now we've got a dilemma. Does ethics change? Does ethics change with the times? And so is ethics a movable system? Well, thankfully, that's why I'm a Buddhist, thankfully, Buddhism came up with a view of ethics. Not harming another sentient being as much as possible. There's your ethics. Bottom line. Looking at what is harming a sentient being and not doing that, and looking at what is being kind, compassionate and understanding. Now, I say as much as possible because I drive my car and I know that I probably kill bugs and things driving. Unfortunately, that's the nature of samsara. I've tried to sometimes save an ant and unfortunately squashed it or drowned it by trying to save it. But my attitude is not to harm. And that's your ethics. So whatever is not harming is considered to be Buddhist ethics. And there you have the temple. You don't have to go, oh well, which age am I in and which is valid? Oh well, this age we steal. Or I'll steal from non-Buddhists. You know? It's not about that. It's about absolutely not harming any sentient beings as much as you can to your best ability. And there's your platform of ethics. And therefore, you don't actually have to think about, oh well, maybe this is, maybe that isn't. I mean, there's subtleties, and within Buddhist ethics, there are subtleties. You know, like you don't leave Dharma material on the ground and step on it. Well, okay, that's not necessarily harming a sentient being directly, that's just information that you need to know. But true ethics is about not harming other beings. And once you've got that nailed, you've actually got the whole of ethics worked out. And it was so refreshing for me, coming from a not particularly strict Christian background, but having these lines and then seeing countries going to war in the name of God. You know, or you know, you can Christians say thou shalt not kill unless you have to actually go to war, then you can and you have God on your side. And I'm not having a go at Christians, because there are extraordinary Christians out there and great Christian mystics and people with great ethics. I'm not saying that, but for me, understanding Buddhism and the fact that we do have these very clear definitions to be able to live our lives and make our lives harmonious with others. And so Buddhists don't go to war. That's just not part of our deal. It has no benefit, it can't help, and it causes suffering. So there we go, we just don't have to do that one. And when I was, and this is before I was a Buddhist actually, but I guess maybe there was some karmic imprints coming through, and it was at the time of the Vietnam War. And pretty much all of you, most of you weren't alive, there might have been one or two, but most of you weren't alive. we were considered, and there'd be, are there any Vietnamese people here at all? Yeah? No? Okay. Anyway, we were told by the powers that be that there was going to be an invasion from China with the communists through Vietnam, and they were going to take over Australia. And so therefore, this was propaganda from America, we had to stop this invasion by invading Vietnam. And we had what was known as conscription, which meant there was a ballot. And when you reached a certain age of 18, interestingly enough, you weren't allowed to vote in the government at that age of 18. You had to vote when you were 21. So at 18, you weren't allowed to vote, but you could go to war. You could be conscripted to go to war. So the government that you couldn't elect could actually take you and conscript you and send you off to war. So it was coming up to the time of when my ballot was going to possibly happen. Now, I could be in or I could be out. And I said to my mother, she said, what are you going to do? I said, if I get in the ballot, I will do the army training. I don't have a problem running through the bush, you know, playing whatever, toy soldiers. I said, but there is absolutely no way I'm going to go to another country and kill anybody. That's it. They can't make me. I won't do it. I'll do their training. The training goes for 12 months. Okay, I'll go and do the training. Doesn't matter. But there is absolutely no, this is before I was a Buddhist, there's absolutely no way I'm going to go to war. She said, what do you do? I said, I'll escape, I'll go hide, I'll go anywhere. I'll go AWOL. I'll go to jail. I'm not doing it. So there was my level of ethics at that time. And a lot of my friends were at the same level. It wasn't just me having this view. It was just like, we're not going to do it. We certainly didn't really believe the American propaganda ourselves. And we certainly didn't want to go out and shoot people. So thankfully, just at that time, Gough Whitlam came in and he stopped conscription, and the Vietnam War finished. So, but it was terrible. It was an invasion, and it was actually wrong information. It wasn't happening, and it was propaganda. So you know, again, this is a level of morality that. You don't actually even have to be a Buddhist to understand. You can just have this particular view. Thankfully, when I came across Buddhism, it was like, oh, wow, this really accords with the way I want to live my life. So, that's it, folks. Any questions to finish off with? Yep. People, sorry, who... Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, this is a good one, yeah. Okay, so someone's sitting next to you complaining about this friend of yours who's absolutely a terrible person, and then if you nod and go, yeah, you're complicit. If you say, I don't want to listen to it, you can be rude. You have to, it depends on the situation. You can be present without adding any energy to it. Okay? This is a technique that a Zen master spoke about, Suzuki Roshi. And it's actually quite useful. If someone is talking rubbish, be completely present to their rubbish, but don't polarise it in your mind. Alright? Don't add, oh, this is rubbish, I don't want to listen to this, and don't agree with it either. Just allow them the energy to do their talking, and just be completely present. And as Suzuki Roshi says, they will see the error of their own conversation. And it actually does work. So you're not trying to manipulate them. You're allowing them to express themselves, but you're not buying into it. So that's one technique. If, however, they're becoming really vicious, you can say, well, actually, I quite like the person and I don't agree with you. You can say that too. And say, look, I actually don't want to talk about this. It makes me upset when you talk about this person this way. So there's there's not really one solution, but there are many different solutions. But you don't have to buy into their friendship by agreeing with them if they're really talking negatively. And sometimes you can say, actually, could you stop that? I don't want to hear it. I don't think that's helpful. So it has to be, like all these situations, you have to be at the coalface at the particular time with that particular person to try and use your wisdom to deal with it. But if it's difficult, just at least be present and allow them to express themselves without adding anything to it or opposing it. Just let them talk, and eventually their energy will finish. Okay, that's all, folks. Thank you once again. Thank you always for inviting me. I really enjoy it. And hopefully I get invited back again sometime. Okay?
Sure.